Welcome to the American Cafe. I'm your host, Ira Melman. The largest community of Liberians outside of Liberia is in New York City. They are, as expected, very concerned about what is happening to their friends and relatives still there.
They're dying, and they want to get out of there. And they want to leave Liberia. It's not a safe zone at all. It's critical for everywhere. It's critical.
Bernard Chessman pays us a visit to the cafe with that story. As concern grows about how to feed a bigger and bigger world population, there are efforts to eat animals we might want to eradicate, like the rat-like nutria and the Asian carp. But as Tom Bonsi reports, there could be a problem of some of those species becoming too popular.
If people start to get a taste for Asian carp, then perhaps it could be turned into a fishery and maybe become popular, and people won't want them to be eradicated.
And why would people building robots be interested in the way a snake moves?
Robots are expensive, and a robot gets stuck in the sand, that's a problem, especially if that sand happens to be, say, on another planet.
Roseanne Scurbo wriggles in with that. All of that and more on this week's American Cafe. More than 8,000 Liberians live in New York City, more than in any other city outside of Liberia itself. As VOA's Bernard Chessman reports, with the Ebola virus ravaging their homeland, there is no peace of mind for these New Yorkers.
Most Liberian immigrants to America live in this community known as Clifton, in the borough of Staten Island, a part of New York City. According to the Reverend Philip Seyrain, the Ebola virus is topic one.
There has been discussions as to what engineered this Ebola. Others said that the Ebola was introduced by an animal from Democratic Republic of Congo. The inhabitants of that land used the animal for food, and there where the Ebola derived from.
Local health officials believe no one in this community has been infected with the virus. This marketplace, however, is suffering just the same. Much of the food is imported from Western Africa, and customers are hard to find, worried about food handling in Africa. Bobby Digi, a community organizer, also worries about a backlash against the Liberian-American community.
They're very concerned that now, because you've had the gentleman, Duncan, who has now passed, who's now deceased, that the nation does not look at the Liberians as, oh, wow, we have to look out for Liberians. It's actually sort of happening subliminally already.
The Reverend James Bestman, who directs the community's Liberian Cultural Association, talks to people in Liberia daily.
They're dying, and they want to get out of there, and they want to leave Liberia. It's not a safe zone at all. It's critical for everywhere. It's critical. The young people, the babies, and some people, their whole family wiped up. And in some areas, the next door neighbor has lost their whole family, and the other people want to move. And even when they move, they have to go to another place, which is not even safe. So it's very tough for Liberia.
At a news conference in New York City Hall, Mayor Bill de Blasio called the virus a painful crisis for the world.
This is a painful time, but it's also a time that the whole international community is recognizing that this is all of our problem. This is something that has to be addressed by action by countries all over the world to help address the problem at its core in West Africa.
The mayor said New York is planning for any contingency. Bernard Chessman, VOA News, Staten Island.
In 2009, Spirit, one of NASA's two Mars rovers, got stuck in the sand. And more recently, the other rover, Curiosity, had to take a detour to avoid the shifting sands of the red planet. This got some scientists to thinking about ways to keep our very expensive robotic probes from getting sidelined by something as inconsequential as a sand trap. VOA's Roseanne Scurbo reports these scientists looked to nature for inspiration.
Deadly snakes were flown to Zoo Atlanta for an experiment that the public never got to see. The scientists used high-speed video cameras to record the position of the snakes as they move sideways up the slopes of different grades, a movement called sidewinding.
Should be good. Yeah, I think you're going to get a really good shot here.
Study co-author Daniel Goldman is associate professor of physics at the Georgia Institute of Technology. He says the snakes proved agile in sand, even shifting sand.
They were quite good at climbing angles, even close to where the sand, the angle at which the sand begins to cascade with just a small perturbation.
Goldman now knows how they did it. Writing in the journal Science, he and colleagues from Georgia Tech, Zoo Atlanta, and Carnegie Mellon University are the first to explain this serpentine movement.
We noticed that the animals were, in fact, sidewinding, using the same kind of pattern of sidewinding they use on hard ground, but laying instead of only a few points of contact on the body contacting the ground, they were essentially laying more and more snake body down on the hill as the incline angle increased.
But that discovery wasn't the end of the experiment. Next into the sand pit was Mod Snake, a meter-long robot composed of 16 identical modules, each 6 centimeters in diameter. Goldman says the bot, developed at Carnegie Mellon University, has a long history of getting in and out of tight places.
It turned out they had actually been using the sidewinding gait in their robot for many years to traverse all kinds of ground, but always had trouble on sandy dune inclines.
Once researchers had quantified the real snake's wave-like movement into programmable data, the next step was to get the robot to climb in the same way.
And those same waves existed in the robot and allowed it to make its maneuvers and allowed us to modify those waves to make the kind of maneuvers that the snake did on sand dunes of different incline. That is, laying down more robot as the hill angle increased.
The researchers ran the same experiment with other snakes closely related to the rattler, and they all failed miserably to sidewind up the inclines. Zoo Atlanta research director Joe Mendelson says the robot model helped explain those failures.
We found a really fascinating system where the snake informs what the robot can do, and then we can manipulate the robot to do the things that either the snake won't do or can't do. And so we have this self-informing system that's really opened up all new parameters, both in snake biology and robotics.
Mendelson adds that the next generation of Mod Snake may be deployed to save lives or explore remote regions on Earth or in space.
Robots are expensive, and a robot gets stuck in the sand, that's a problem, especially if that sand happens to be, say, on another planet. Right, or a very distant from an exploration post. And you realize, part of going into this, we realize the fact that sidewinders never, ever, ever get stuck in the sand.
The researchers hope the new sidewinder bot will navigate sand dunes just as well. Roseanne Scherbel, VOA News, Washington.
Yeah, different people have been looking at...
International travel and trade has had an unwelcome side effect in terms of spreading weeds, pests, and non-native fish and animals. Wherever you live, you may have seen traditional eradication methods employed, like herbicide spraying, biological controls, targeted hunting, or removal by hand. In Oregon recently, another control method saw a brief revival, namely cooking and eating them. More than 200 diners in the U.S. Northwest paid handsomely to nibble on course after course of invasive species. Correspondent Tom Bonsi reports it may be difficult to eat our way out of this problem, but it can be satisfying to try.
Creative chefs and adventurous diners converged on a banquet hall at an Oregon vineyard.
This is a piquillo pepper stuffed with crayfish. The invasive type of crayfish, not the native ones.
Chef Matt Bennett of Albany, Oregon, led off the gastronomic adventure.
This one is dandelion green spanakopita.
The point of this affair was to highlight the range of edible invasive weeds, birds, fish, and mammals around us. These invaders are costly to control. They crowd out native plants and animals and can change entire landscapes. One slogan heard here, if you can't beat them, eat them.
And then this one is our house-made wild boar sausage that we're cooking in Sky High Brewing's berry invasive ale.
And those are just the appetizers. Still to come, buttermilk fried bullfrog legs, braised wild boar with Himalayan blackberry glaze, and Asian carp roulettes, None of those are native to this area. Diners Rosamaria and Greg Mann sampled deep-fried nutria. That's a rodent native to South America, where it's known as coipu. However, this one was trapped locally.
The nutria was a little chewy, but it was very tasty.
Maybe a little less, maybe a little more tender than a rabbit, though. Okay. It was good. I enjoyed it.
So can you see them becoming popular ever?
They'd have to do some kind of heavy PR for the nutria. They're not really pretty looking, and yeah, no.
The title of this annual dinner is Eradication by Mastication. But even the group putting on the gala admits you can't get rid of the invaders by eating them. Tom Kay directs the Institute for Applied Ecology.
The problem's too big for that. And also the parts of some of these things that we eat, some of the plants, if we just say, for example, collect blackberries, that does not eradicate blackberries. You need to mow them or do more in order to get blackberries out.
Do you know gumbo?
One of the celebrity chefs on hand made an energetic case for the culinary approach. Philippe Parola from Louisiana demonstrated for a rapt audience how to butcher a nutria and fillet an enormous carp.
I'm turning the beast to some serious money here.
Chef Philippe says harvest pressure could keep invaders like this in check.
And when I hear that cooking the problem is not the solution, well, I'm not saying it is a solution, but it can be part of the solution. And if you give us a chance, and if you work with us, I guarantee you we can make it a heck of a solution.
The big three Parola would like to see on more than a few menus are nutria, Asian carp, and feral pigs. In North America, imported nutria escaped from fur farms and now are causing widespread environmental damage. Meanwhile, federal and state agencies in the American Midwest are spending tens of millions of dollars per year to control the spread of several Asian carp species, hoping to keep them out of the Great Lakes. Wild pigs, which carry diseases and parasites, threaten livestock and damaged crops, and they're now found in 45 states. But Wyatt Williams, a member of the Oregon Invasive Species Council, hopes the exotic entrees don't get too popular on dinner plates.
If people start to get a taste for Asian carp, then perhaps it could be turned into a fishery and maybe become popular and people won't want them to be eradicated.
Meat inspection and public health rules present another hurdle when it comes to wild game in particular. If an American consumer or restaurant wanted to buy wild boar chops or nutria nuggets, they'd have a hard time finding them. As several of the chefs at this invasive species dinner noted, the food safety system in the U.S. is not set up to handle wild harvested meat. For VOA News, I'm Tom Bonsi near Salem, Oregon.
Three days a week, a bus pulls up in downtown San Francisco to offer showers for the homeless. Michael Sullivan reports the mobile showers are provided by a small charity called Lava Me, a play on the Spanish word for wash me.
Those who live on the streets struggle to find basic services, something as simple as a bath or shower. This San Francisco charity is helping by providing showers for the homeless three times a week. Martin Rodriguez, who keeps all of his belongings in a folding grocery cart, came to clean up.
I'm waiting for housing, you know, and I sleep in the streets, so I need to take a shower in the blue bus. It's a good service.
The project got underway in June after an internet campaign raised $75,000 to refurbish an old bus. The internet giant Google provided an additional $100,000. Lava May's Leia Filler says this is a one-of-a-kind service in San Francisco or anywhere else.
No one, as far as we know, is turning old buses into shower buses like we do and operating on a kind of level of collaboration with the city and local government, with the nonprofits, with the private sector that we operate with.
Volunteers help clean the bus and keep things running smoothly. Volunteer Lisa Olswing has been helping for the past 3 months.
It's brought me such joy. You know, at the same time, it's so sad because people have to use this service, that they're on the street, and I never forget that.
The showers offer a chance to feel clean and refreshed, says a young homeless man named Justin Van Horn.
It's nice to feel my skin and not feel dirt on it and wash the smell off.
Lava May founder Denise Sandoval says there are food programs for the homeless, but few sanitary facilities. She spearheaded this project after hearing a homeless woman complain about the problem. As word of the shower bus spread, Sandoval says interest has grown dramatically.
And I instantly started getting contacted by people from all over saying, help us create something like this in our community. So as far away as Mongolia and Ghana to just down the way in Palo Alto and San Jose, we're beginning to have conversations about how we can support those efforts.
The nonprofit group Lava May has three more buses waiting to be retrofitted with showers to expand its outreach to San Francisco's homeless. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, San Francisco.
Freedom of the press and using drug money to fund a war are the main subjects in the film Kill the Messenger. It's based on the true story of journalist Gary Webb, who was discredited after writing newspaper articles about the source of money the United States used to fund the fight against Nicaragua's communist government. VOA's Penelope Pulu has more on that.
Was the government aware that you were smuggling tons of cocaine into the United States?
Yes, the government knew.
In Kill the Messenger, Oscar nominee Jeremy Renner portrays Gary Webb, a reporter for the small California newspaper, the San Jose Mercury News. The film follows him in 1996 as he stumbles on information that in the 1980s, the CIA looked the other way while its Nicaraguan allies, the Contras, smuggled cocaine into the U.S. to fund their war against Nicaragua's communist Sandinista government. Webb is warned not to publish his findings.
We don't agree with everything that happens in our agencies, so this is a little awkward for us. But you're getting into some sensitive areas. There are ongoing operations you're in danger of exposing.
Webb refuses to back down. He publishes a three-part series called The Dark Alliance, writing not only about the connection between the CIA and the drug traffickers, which was known, but alleging that their large-scale smuggling operation led to a crack epidemic in the African-American neighborhoods of Los Angeles and elsewhere.
My angle is that the American government knew drugs were put on the streets to fund an illegal war.
What you want to say happened never happened.
Then why am I here?
American kids were going to die in that war.
American kids did die, and they're still dying. Just not the ones you care about.
From then onward, says Jeremy Renner, Webb's life unravels.
Big interest, big media getting scooped and making Gary the story or discrediting him or tearing his story apart versus furthering the journalism, which is absolute shame and travesty, I think, if you ask me.
The Washington Post, the New York Times, and the Los Angeles Times, which had not given the CIA-Contra connection much coverage in the 1980s, dismissed Webb's conclusions about the crack epidemic as speculative. Eventually, his own paper backed down. Jeremy Renner says it was the typical David versus Goliath story, only this time, Goliath won.
And not to discredit San Jose Mercury News, I just think that it became bigger, and even for Gary, the whole story became much bigger than any of them were ever used to, and don't know really how to handle it ultimately, except Gary, who just needs more support to go dig and find more truth.
Investigative reporter Robert Perry was the first to break the CIA-Contra story for the Associated Press in 1985. He agrees with Renner.
Webb did something that was very important that we did not do. We had focused on the Contra movement and the importation of drugs through Central America into the United States. What Webb did was look at what happened once the drugs got here.
According to filmmaker Michael Cuesta, Webb did not have direct evidence that linked Contra drug trafficking to the crack epidemic.
It wasn't nuanced enough, and it was very easy for these other papers to find little flaws in it.
But Webb's reporting had substantial merit, says Perry.
Well, one of the most important things that Webb accomplished, and the Black Caucus accomplished, was to finally force the CIA to do a serious investigation of this real problem.
By then, Webb's career had been destroyed. He committed suicide in 2004. Cuesta hopes his film will renew the conversation about the integrity of the press.
If you call it a movie about indicting any particular establishment, like government, or I think it's more about media.
Thought my job was to tell the public the truth, the facts, pretty or not.
Not finished!
This is a true story.
Some stories are just too true to tell.
Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
Jousting, in which mounted knights tried to unhorse an opponent with a lance, was a widely popular sport in medieval Europe. More than 700 years later, it's still practiced by people all over the United States. Some go all in for period costume from the age of chivalry, but many others enjoy it as a family sport in a more recreational way. That is called ring jousting. VOA's June So introduces us to a family of jousters in the eastern U.S. state of Maryland that has kept the tradition alive for generations. Carol Pearson narrates.
Bob Enfield, the rings are hung. The track is clear. Charge, Sir Knight.
Bob Enfield is defending his Maryland State Jousting Championship, a title he's held three times. Last year, he also won the national champion title.
Three rings.
But Enfield does not think he can match the wins his father made before retiring from the sport at age 75.
Dad was an excellent rider in his day. He won four national championships and eight state championships.
Leon Enfield started the family's tradition of jousting in 1947. He became the first state champion a decade later.
At one point in time, about 8 years ago, there were 11 of my family riding, competing, and it was four generations.
His granddaughter, Marley, started jousting when she was only 2 and a half.
It's easy to learn, but it takes a lot of time to practice and to stay good at it. I just wanted to carry on the family tradition.
Jousting is considered the oldest equestrian sport in the world. Knights used lances to knock opponents off their horses. These days, full contact jousting has become more theatrical, and armored jousters perform largely at Renaissance festivals. Ring jousting became Maryland's official sport in 1962. Vicki Betts, president of the state's Jousting Tournament Association, says horsemanship and precision are the keys to success.
And the joy of ring jousting is the camaraderie we all share. We're together almost every weekend from May until October, but we're really competing against ourselves. I have to have more rings than the next person to win.
At this final state contest of the year, 60 jousters of all ages compete in five classes, from novice to championship, where Bob Enfield had to defend his title. He also competed in the professional class with his 19-year-old son, Bradley.
He's pretty much taught me everything I know about the sport, so it's fun to go out there and ride against him, see if I can beat him.
You're watching the professional class started on one-inch rings.
Four contestants, including both Enfields, tied in the first round. In the second run, with the ring size reduced by half, Bradley won first place and his father took second.
I'm really tickled that we finished that way. The fact that he beat me, that means a lot to me. That means I trained him well.
Bob also lost his state champion title, but he says he's happy as the sport keeps going in the family, and he looks forward to competing again with his son next year. For producer June So, I'm Carol Pearson, VOA News.
That is all the time we have for this week's program. Our thanks to executive producer Bob Doty. If you'd like to hear more about these stories, check our website at voanews.com. And we'd love to hear from you. Send us an email from wherever you are to our studios in Washington, D.C. You can email us at americancafe@voanews.com. Why not give us a telephone call? Dial the international code, then the number 1 for the United States, followed by 202-205-9942. When you hear the VOA ID, press 05 and then leave your questions or your comments. For all the folks here at VOA, I'm Ira Melman. We'll see you next time on American Cafe.